Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies. I'm Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, we interview the author or editor of a new book in genocide studies. This time, I'm thrilled to have Jenny Burnett on the show. Jenny is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Louisville and has written a wonderful new book about the aftermath of genocide in Rwanda. Titled Genocide Lives in Us, Women, Memory, and Silence in Rwanda, and published by the University of Wisconsin Press, the book examines the lasting impact of the violence in Rwanda, especially in the 1990s and first decade of this century. Jenny examines not just the immediate aftermath of genocide, but the complicated military and political conflicts of the following years and their effects on individual and communal attempts at recovery and reconciliation. The book focuses on women, but has much to say about broader aspects of the Rwandan attempt to live in the aftermath of genocide. I particularly appreciated her ability to combine political and social analysis with narratives of individual experiences. I'm looking forward to talking about her, or with her, about the book and the process of writing it. So, welcome, Jenny, and thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Let's start our conversation just by giving you a chance to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be an academic who studies Rwanda.
Okay. Well, it goes back to when I was in high school, and I became a human rights activist with Amnesty International. In fact, initially, I joined because a friend told me about the organization, and I thought that was interesting to defend human rights. I had to ask her what human rights were. And then it was especially great for me when I came home from an Amnesty International meeting and told my father where I'd been, and he got very angry. So I was certain that I was going to stay a member of the organization then, sort of a safe rebellion against my parents. But I continued my work with Amnesty International, doing grassroots human rights organizing all the way through college. And then when I graduated college, I found a job as a technical writer doing fundraising for not-for-profit organizations in the United States. I enjoyed the job. I learned quite a lot doing it, but I knew I didn't want to stay in that for the rest of my career. And I eventually decided to go back to graduate school. And at the time I graduated from college, it was right when the genocide in Rwanda was going on. At that time, I didn't watch the news on a daily basis, but I began to pay attention. And in particular, I was bothered by the way the genocide was explained in materials coming from Amnesty International. They said things like tall people were killing other people because they were short. I mean, the other way around, actually, short people were killing other people because they were tall, because they were Hutu and Tutsi. And it just didn't make sense with anything I knew about human motivations to violence and those kinds of things. So I was troubled by the explanation. And so that's what drew my attention to Rwanda. And I eventually applied to graduate school. I decided to apply to anthropology programs because I thought that the methods of anthropology were best suited to answering the kinds of questions that interested me. And in addition, I found that the methods of anthropology best fit with what I like to do. I like to sit down and talk to people. At the most basic level, that is what the method of anthropology, cultural anthropology is sitting down and talking to people. And so I started a graduate program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I was lucky enough to find two of the leading specialists on Rwanda at the university, Catherine Newberry, who was in the political science department at that time, and David Newberry, who was in the history department at that time. So I worked closely with them, as well as with anthropologists who had been studying war and identity, such as Catherine Lutz and Dorothy Holland, as well as many others in the department. So that's sort of how I got interested and developed this project. Initially, my project, I was planning to look at what was the daily life of war like for non-combatants. By the time I went to Rwanda for the first time in 1997, as a graduate student, I found that Rwandans weren't really willing at that point in time to talk about the past, to talk about the genocide. And there's a variety of reasons for that. And so my project evolved, and instead I focused on sort of the everyday life of the aftermath of genocide and the aftermath of conflict, and how do people rebuild their lives, and how do they try to recreate a meaningful life in the aftermath of unimaginable violence.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about how anthropologists answer questions. And I know some of our listeners will have a background in anthropology, but many will not. Can you say a little bit more about how anthropologists would approach the kind of questions you ask and the kind of research process you went through?
Sure. I mean, historically, the defining methodology of anthropology is what's called participant observation. At its most basic level, it means participating in the activity that you're observing. How you do that in any given situation can result in a wide variety of things. For me, what it meant, since I was focusing on women and women's organizations in Rwanda, it meant that I became a member of several Rwandan women's associations. I would attend meetings as a member, but sometimes associations would invite me as an observer as well. So I would participate in meetings of the women's associations. I lived for a year on a hill in rural Rwanda. At that time, the community did not have running water. It did not have electricity. It didn't have regular public transportation to town. It was 20 kilometers from the nearest town. So driving, I bought this old beat up pickup truck, who I called Esmeralda. And it took Esmeralda and I usually about 30 minutes to get to town on good days. The longest it ever took me was 8 hours one day during the rainy season. And Esmeralda got stuck in several mud pits and had 2 flat tires. There is no AAA in Rwanda. So when I got the flat tire, the first time I got a flat tire, I changed it myself. I was very quick with changing tires. But the second flat tire, I then had to find someone who was willing to carry the wheel and the tire back into town, get the tire changed for me and bring it back to me. So that was quite an adventure. What I discovered living in rural Rwanda, I did put in a solar panel so I could run a laptop, and I had some lights, and I could play a radio if I wanted to. But what I found was it's surprisingly easy to live in a house that's set up for no running water and no electricity. And I actually had quite an enjoyable life there. Rwanda's near the equator, so the sun rises about 6 a.m. every day, and it sets at 6 p.m. every day. And I would go to bed by, 8 p.m. would be late, because when there's no light, you don't have a lot of motivation to stay up very late. And I discovered the joys of getting plenty of sleep. And I was a much more sane person getting 8 or 10 hours of sleep at night instead of my usual 6 that I find I fall into when I'm in the United States.
Well, I have to say, anthropologists sound far more hardier types than historians, maybe.
Perhaps that's true. I don't know. I did spend a summer last year in an archive in Belgium, and I decided I'm not cut out for history. Don't mind sitting on a hard chair, shuffling through dusty papers, all that engaging.
I was going to say, I've not done any research in Africa, never been to Rwanda, but I've been to Kenya a couple times for a while, and I understand the experience of driving a beat-up pickup over roads that would not be called roads in the United States. And
yes.
I'm still sometimes surprised that I made it through. But and you were this book take a long time to write. What kind of challenges and opportunities did it offer you to be thinking about this and be engaged and immersed in Rwanda for 13, 14, 15 years?
Yeah, well, what I can say is I never intended for this book to take as long as it did to write. I consider this book my first child, but it was conceived long before my biological children were born, long after they were. So I think it took me a long time to finish the book in a format that I felt merited publication, that it took me a long time to figure out what needed to be said about life in the aftermath of genocide in Rwanda, what needed to be said about women and memory. So there were many drafts. I mean, the first draft of this book was my dissertation, which I finished in 2005. It wasn't a terrible dissertation, but it's not the best dissertation I think was ever written. But it was a good first draft. And from there, I went on to change it. In addition, I think the methods of anthropology to arrive at valid conclusions require a lot of time, both a lot of time for gathering data and a lot of time for analyzing and understanding data. I think one thing that anthropology does as a social science that's quite different from the other social sciences is we have a greater demand for contextualizing data in that to understand why at a specific moment a woman in a public meeting falls silent takes a great deal of knowledge of culture and the history of that place in order to understand and interpret that silence. So that's, I think, part of it. In addition, you know, the fieldwork I did was actually quite difficult. It was difficult physically, but it was also terribly difficult emotionally. And it took me a long time, I think, to come to terms with that.
Yeah. And I want to come back to that in a little bit. Let's turn to the book now. And one of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you're very careful to define precisely the kinds of terms and the kinds of periods you're talking about. So now I want to start just by asking you to kind of briefly recapitulate some of those. And so why don't we start where many books about Rwanda end in 1994 – or ignore the kind of broader context after that. You're very careful to appreciate the kind of complicated course of military and political events in the following decade. So can you give the listeners a kind of a brief summary of the political history that forms the context for your book starting, say, in 1990 and moving through the first decade of the century?
Sure. So in 1990 in Rwanda, President Juvenal Habyarimana had been in power since 1971, almost 20 years. When he came to power, it was through a military coup, and then he instituted what was called at the time by political scientists a single-party state, modeled in large part after what President Nyerere had done in Tanzania. And Nyerere had modeled his a bit off of Maoist China. But so in a sort of African kind of socialism, all Rwandans at birth became members of the party of Habyarimana, which was known as MRND, its acronym, Mouvement Révolutionnaire National Démocratique. There had been basically 20 years of peace in Rwanda, but there hadn't been political freedom. There wasn't a lot of space to debate things. There were elections, but the elections had predetermined outcomes. So by 1989, there began to be movement within Rwanda to liberalize the political system, to allow there to be political parties. A letter was written by a group of intellectuals in 1989 demanding that Habyarimana allow for democratization. And this is at the same moment when the international community is beginning to tie development aid to democracy, not just in Rwanda, but all across Africa and South America as well. And so these ideas begin to be debated. And then in October of 1990, on October 1st of 1990, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is a political party and a rebel movement that was founded in Uganda among Rwandan refugees who had either fled Rwanda or had grown up in exile, they attack Rwanda with the intention of overthrowing Habyarimana, liberating the country, and bringing in multi-party politics. So President Habyarimana was quite taken by surprise. The RPF, as they're called by their acronym, actually got quite far into Rwanda because of the surprise. The French provided some military assistance, as did Zaire, or the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and helped repel them. And so then after that, we have basically a prolonged civil war going on. The RPF switches to more guerrilla-style tactics in their warfare, but they did occupy a large section of the country. And it's in 1993, finally, there are peace negotiations. They take place in Arusha, Tanzania. And in mid-1993, a document is signed, a peace accord is signed, known as the Arusha Peace Accords. And the peace accords call for a transition to multi-party politics. They call for integration of the RPF into the Rwandan military. And they called for the registration of political parties and a competitive democracy. Now, unfortunately, the peace accords didn't result in a total end of fighting. There was still ongoing fighting, but mostly there was a detente for a period of time. Also in this context, once multi-party politics started, and particularly after the RPF invasion of Rwanda, some leaders in Habyarimana's government, including his wife, and even there's some evidence that he participated in this, began propaganda against the RPF. And the RPF was founded primarily by Tutsis who had been in exile, but did include some Hutu. But the propaganda focused on Tutsis and said that the RPF wanted to reinstitute the monarchy and would exploit Hutu and wanted to enslave Hutu and these kinds of things. So you also have this racist propaganda that begins in the early 90s and continues. It continues in the form of print media and in particular on the radio. So in this context also then the political parties inside Rwanda founded youth wings. Youth in Rwanda is defined as anyone who's unmarried between the ages of about 17 and 30. So the youth wings of political parties, those that were associated with the Hutu extremist political parties, they are then trained as militias. They're given military training. They're taught how to fight with weapons and other kinds of things. And these youth wings become what are the militias during the genocide that led the killing. They were called the Interahamwe is the word that most people are familiar with, but the CDR political parties was also called Mhuza Mugambi. Essentially, Interahamwe means those who attack together. Mhuza Mugambi has a similar meaning. So these young men, the men who joined the militias, they tended to be young, unemployed men without land. They were kind of trapped in this perpetual state of unmarried young adulthood because in Rwanda, for a man to marry, he has to have either a job and the ability to support a family, or he has to have farmland and a house to support a family. So these men were largely locked out of any sort of social mobility and quite frustrated. And so they were easily mobilized to nefarious ends. So things in Rwanda after the signing of the 1993 peace accords became quite tense. Everyone felt like something was going to happen, something bad was going to happen, but no one was quite sure what. And then it's on April 6, 1994, President Habyarimana was flying back from Arusha, where he was in peace negotiations. He was flying back on his presidential jet. And as the jet came in to land at the Kigali International Airport, it was shot down. To this day, it's not known precisely who shot the plane down. There's a lot of theories. There's little evidence to really make it clear who did it. But what is very clear is how the Hutu extremists in the government and in the military made use of this event. And what they did is they said they mobilized the militias and they mobilized the army. And they said, listen, the RPF has killed our president and we have to fight them and eliminate the enemy to ensure that they don't win. Hutu extremists take over the government and then implement the genocide, which had been planned in advance. They had lists of people who should be killed. On the list, the initial list had prominent Tutsi leaders in Rwanda, but it also had many Hutu. The prime minister at the time was from one of the opposition political parties. She was a woman. She was Hutu, but she was on the list because it was known that she would oppose the genocide. And she was killed in the first days, along with 10 Belgian peacekeepers who were there guarding her. Also, many other prominent Hutu journalist names were on the list. That's sort of how the genocide begins. In some communities, the genocide begins in the early morning hours of April 7th. Other places, local communities refused to implement the genocide until later in April. Particularly in southern Rwanda, most of those communities refused to implement the genocide until April 21st, when the governor of what was then called Butare Prefecture, Butare Province, he was removed from office and replaced. He had refused to implement the genocide in his province. When he's replaced, the genocide then begins in the south. But in other places, it began immediately on the 7th. During the genocide, the instructions given in most places was to kill the RPF, kill the enemy, kill the RPF, and kill the RPF's accomplices. But as Scott Strauss describes in his book on Rwanda, everybody understood that meant kill Tutsi. And they understood that because of all the racist propaganda that had preceded it. When I'm teaching my students about Rwanda, it's often easy to imagine that for some reason Africans are quite different than we are United States or Canada. But my experience is they're not any different than us. Yes, there were racist, violent people who were happy to go out and kill Tutsis in the genocide. But the vast majority of the population were reluctant to become involved and were pressured into becoming involved. I mean, other people's books deal much more in depth with that phenomenon, but it is an important thing to understand.
Sure.
So then when the genocide is ongoing, the RPF immediately re-begins the war to take the country. Not only because they see it as a military opportunity to win the war, but also to try to save Tutsi and others targeted in the genocide from the killing. And they did have I don't know if it was a regiment or a battalion that was stationed in the capital city at the parliament building as part of the peace accords. And then they had occupied the northern part of the country. So they re-began their battle. So the genocide occurs in the midst of an ongoing civil war with battle lines. Those things at times became confusing and blurred. often civilians weren't sure which side of the battle lines they were on. And it was often hard for Tutsis who managed to find places to hide. It was often hard for them to figure out when they could flee to safety behind the RPF lines. Those who did find safety with the RPF were protected by the RPF, and they were often the young men and male civilians of fighting age were then integrated into the RPF and added to their army. But the genocide ends in Rwanda not when there's an international intervention, rather it ends when essentially the RPF wins the war. Now, several months in, there finally was an international intervention led by the French, known as the Turquoise Operation. And French peacekeeping troops entered Rwanda and occupied the southwestern part of the country. In the zones where the French occupied the country, most of the killing stopped. They did protect Tutsis if they found them alive. The genocidal government and most of the army, along with about 2 million civilians, fled Rwanda when the genocide ended. They fled either because they had been involved in the genocide and they were afraid of retribution from the RPF, and others fled simply because they were told that the RPF would kill them if they stayed. And so they were just afraid that they would become victims of the violence. And so that's sort of my book then focuses on the period that follows that. In the aftermath of the genocide, you have the RPF occupying three quarters of the country. You have the Turquoise Zone occupied by the French peacekeepers. And then you have the former governments, the militias, and the army. Most of them flee into what is then Zaire, what's today Democratic Republic of the Congo, and they end up in refugee camps. It's at this point that you have this massive international response, because when we see refugees in the Congo dying from dysentery, the international community says, oh, here we have innocent victims, let's help them. And so you have this massive effort to bring assistance to the refugees in eastern Zaire. What happens in the end then is the refugee camps come under the control of the former government. And the former government begins organizing a military resistance and sending people into Rwanda to attack, to try to unsettle or disrupt the RPF, the government that the RPF founded. And so it's eventually the new government in Rwanda keeps saying to the international community, you have to do something about these armed groups in the camps. Our security is in danger. There isn't any organized response. And so it's in late 1996, in October, that the Rwandan military, in collaboration with the Ugandans and in collaboration with some Congolese who are in exile, attack the Congo, attack Zaire, to dismantle the camps by force. And so between October 1996 and early 1997, essentially you have this flood of refugees coming back into Rwanda, not because they chose to, but because they had to decide whether to flee the fighting further into Zaire or to come back to Rwanda. Mm-hmm. Also in early 1997, Tanzania ejects most of the Rwandan refugees who have been in western Tanzania near the border with Rwanda. So you have this massive flood of refugees coming back. They're quite afraid when they arrive. They're afraid of reprisals from the RPF. Also, many of them participated in the genocide, so they're afraid of being arrested and imprisoned for what they've done. But also, many of those who didn't participate in the genocide are also afraid of retribution from genocide survivors, fear of persecution from the government. And that's the first time I went to Rwanda was in April of 1997. And it was a quite tense situation. At that time in Rwanda, very little had been done to repair what was destroyed in the genocide. Part of what was destroyed in the genocide, it was destroyed simply by the battle between the RPF and the former army. But also it was an intentional strategy of the genocidal government, as they withdrew, they intentionally destroyed the infrastructure of the country to sort of leave nothing for the new government. And so when I first arrived in Rwanda, when you drove around the city, there were no stoplights working. The roads were full of potholes. None of the streetlights worked. You weren't ever quite sure what you would find inside a store, because often the outside of the store would say it was a pharmacy, and then you'd go in and it was a grocery store. They put up new signs to indicate what it was. There were no street signs. There was very little order. And also at that time, people were afraid. There were every night you could hear gunfire. Sometimes you'd hear grenades. It was always unclear what that was related to, whether it was crime that was being committed or whether the new army had found insurgents hiding somewhere. It was never quite clear what was going on. It was very difficult to get information about it. So at that time in Rwanda, you would not see civilians walking the streets after dark. Which these days in Rwanda is completely different. The streets are flooded with people in the evening hours. There are street lights. There are operating stoplights. Rwanda today is one of the few places where I don't feel afraid walking alone after dark. I don't do that in my own city where I live now in Louisville, Kentucky. I avoid walking alone after dark. In Rwanda, I don't feel in danger when I'm walking after dark by myself. There's very little crime in the streets of Rwanda these days.
That's remarkable. That's remarkable. So much of your book addresses this question of how people tried to live in the aftermath of this conflict and in the midst of this conflict, since as you just suggested, the conflict itself continues long after 1994.
Yes.
So let's start. How did the Rwandan government attempt to address the genocide, to remember the genocide, to respond to the genocide? What is the kind of top-down understanding of the genocide, and how did they try and make sure it didn't happen again?
Yes. So then the RPF, after they win the war in July of 1994, they put in place a new government. They call the government the Government of National Unity. They announced that there will be an initial transition period of 5 years in which people would be appointed to the cabinets and to the parliament according to the distribution of seats outlined in the Arusha Peace Accords. However, they do outline that any of the political parties who promoted the genocide or implemented the genocide would be excluded from the new government. But in general, the appointments in the new government followed the outlines of the Arusha Peace Accords. And then in the immediate months afterwards, there was just an attempt to meet the basic needs of the surviving population. I think it's hard for us to imagine, but, you know, how do you have a government when you might have a government building, but inside it there are no desks, there are no chairs, there's no pieces of paper, there's no pencils. How do you create a government from nothing? So the first few months, essentially, because it was the best that they could do, the army would run the local government administration. There would be local government administrators appointed. But then there was a decision in the new government that they had to prosecute those who had committed genocide. And so in 1994, late 1994, early 1995, you had this initiative to write a law to outline what is the crime of genocide and how should it be punished. And that law established four categories of responsibility for the genocide. Category one being the most heinous crimes, and category four being the lowest level crime. So the kinds of things that fell into category one were planning the genocide, organizing massacres, murder, sexual torture. Those kinds of crimes ended up in category one. Category two was cases of simple murder, participation in groups that killed. Category three were lower level crimes, such as participating in parties in sort of groups that were looking for people in hiding, turning people over to be killed by others. And category four is essentially property crimes. There was a lot of property crime associated with the genocide. Houses were looted and destroyed. Livestock was stolen, slaughtered, and eaten. Simple household items, clothing, were also stolen. I know early on in my research, it was actually the very first time I went to Rwanda in 1997. I interviewed a genocide widow in the south of Rwanda. And I said, "What do you think about reconciliation?" And she became quite angry. And she said something essentially like, "You foreigners, you come here and ask such stupid questions. How can you ask me about reconciliation when my neighbor's children are wearing my dead children's clothing? When they're eating their dinner off of my table and sitting on my chairs and cooking their food in pots they stole from my house? How can you ask me about reconciliation when I'm here in my house and I have nothing? And everything I had before is either destroyed or it's been taken by them." And so I think I learned my lesson very quickly not to ask about reconciliation.
Yeah, sure.
That doesn't mean that there wasn't reconciliation, didn't happen, but it wasn't the right way to go about understanding that phenomenon. But anyways, the government's attempt to address it, that was initially what they did. Things that came later on was the creation of genocide memorial sites. Mm-hmm. One aspect of the genocide, which is often difficult to comprehend, you have approximately 800,000 people killed in the span of 4 months in Rwanda. That is a lot of dead bodies. And often at large massacre sites, which often occurred in churches, schools, government offices, in some places, the bodies were just left in situ where they were. For a while, the government maintained some of those sites, particularly those that occurred in churches, as memorial sites and as physical evidence of the genocide. Later, there were efforts to gather the remains and to bury them in mass graves. And give them consecrated burials. Usually at most of those burial ceremonies, there would be a Catholic priest, a Protestant pastor, and a Muslim imam to consecrate the graves. And the decision to make them mass graves, there were a couple of motivations. One is that many of those who died don't have anyone left alive to give them burials. But also, the government decided that it was more appropriate to, even for those victims who might have remaining family members, that was still better in terms of national memory to bury them all in centralized sites. Another thing that happened, and this began as early as 1995, was that every April there is a national month of mourning for the genocide. Most of the time that I was living in Rwanda between 1999 and 2001, it was an entire month, but the first week of it was the most important period. At that time, it began on April 1st and ended on April 7th. During that week, all nightclubs would be closed. The national radio station only played what they called appropriate music to the situation. There would be ceremonies held always on April 7th. But the entire month, people would observe a period of mourning for the genocide. In later years, I'm not sure exactly when, it was around 2006, I think, the government changed that practice. And now in Rwanda, the period of mourning for the genocide begins on April 7th. And it draws to a close on July 4th, which is now celebrated as Liberation Day. And so it's that entire period. These days in Rwanda, during that period of time, schools or universities will schedule a time during that period to make a pilgrimage to a genocide memorial site to go and have a ceremony to give respect to the dead. But that's an important part of sort of a national memory for the genocide to ensure that it's not forgotten. Another aspect of the government's program to ensure that genocide would never happen again in Rwanda is its policy of national unity. Since its founding as a political party and rebel movement in exile, the Rwandan Patriotic Front had its policy of national unity. And they taught all of their recruits that these categories, Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa, were politicized by the Belgian colonialists, that before colonialism, Rwandans lived together in peace and harmony, and that there were not conflicts between Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa, and that Rwandans are one people, and that these divisions of the past need to be forgotten and buried. And these days in Rwanda, it's not just impolite, but it's really considered incredibly rude and even slightly politically dangerous to ask the question, what is your ethnicity? Or what is your race in Rwanda? And I mean, you can understand this, given that in 1994, whether you lived or died in part depended on your answer to that question, it can be quite hurtful to ask an individual that question. It can evoke a very strong emotional response from them. But it's also that Rwandans know that they're not supposed to be caring about these distinctions anymore, that they're all Rwandan. So these days, if you ask a Rwandan, you know, what are you? The answer to the question is, I'm a Rwandan. Which, of course, makes research, it presents special challenges in research. Yeah. Because you can't ask that question. Although, you know, anyone designing a research study about Rwanda will say, well, we have to know, you know, what percent of the respondents are Tutsi and what percent are Hutu. The other reality is that sometimes the answer to that question isn't really straightforward. There was a lot of intermarriage in Rwanda in the 70s and 80s, even before that. If your mother was Tutsi and your father was Hutu, you should be then Hutu because it passed patrilineal from father to children. But many children of Tutsi mothers who had Hutu fathers were killed in the genocide. Sometimes even by members of their father's family. You know, if you had a Tutsi father and a Hutu mother, you were Tutsi. But sometimes your mother's family might protect you and hide you and save you. Other times they might kill you or cause you to be killed. So for these people sort of caught in the middle, it can be quite complicated. And imagine being a child where your father's family is responsible for killing your mother and your siblings. It can be quite difficult. Often in the aftermath of the genocide, these people in mixed families found themselves rejected by both sides of their family. Let's say you had a Hutu father and a Tutsi mother. Your mother's family would reject you, saying, well, you're Hutu and you killed our people and we don't want anything to do with you anymore. And then your father's family rejected you because they said, well, your people have put all of us in prison and we don't need to help you. Let your people help you. It can also be hard for people who have this experience of being both or being neither. It's just easier to just be Rwandan.
Yeah, you talk about how at the same time, in some ways, you get the elimination of social categories, ethnic categories like Hutu or Tutsi. You get the emergence of new kind of categories, categories like victims or survivors of genocide, widows or returnees. And here you distinguish between old returnees and new returnees.
Right.
Can you really talk about what those are and then talk about how that's impact individual people's attempts to come to terms with the past?
Yeah. So although the government has this policy of national unity, we don't talk about Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa anymore. The problem, or what becomes problematic, is, of course, you can't talk about the genocide without talking about these things, because it's what caused mm-hmm. you to be killed. But it's also that the genocide memorial sites and the annual commemoration ceremonies, they have a tendency to reinforce these categories, because what Rwandans talk about now instead is being a genocide survivor or being a genocide victim, and or being a perpetrator or being a killer or being an old returnee. Old returnee means that your family went into exile in the late colonial period or early in the post-colonial period in the 60s or 70s, and you remain in exile until the RPF wins the war in 94, and then you came back. That's an old returnee. The new returnees are all of those civilians who went into exile in 1994, fleeing the RPF, and then who returned to Rwanda in 1996, 1997, or after. Often not returning by choice, but returning because they didn't have anywhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And so these new categories, victim, perpetrator, old returnee, new returnee, became stand-ins for ethnic talk. Mm-hmm. So the categories of victim, survivor, old returnee are sort of metonyms or replacements for this concept of Tutsi. And perpetrator or families who have members in prison or new returnee became stand-ins for this concept of Hutu. And so what happens then is that the commemoration ceremonies, because there's talk about the genocide, and I'm not saying that's wrong, of course, that has to be done. But then what happens is that there are, for example, Hutus who were targeted in the genocide because they supported the RPF or because they supported another opposition party or because they opposed the genocide. They often feel left out of that category of victim or survivor. And so that causes sort of new problems. And so these categories, Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa, have been replaced by these new ones. And so the distinctions don't entirely disappear.
And one of the things you talk about, and you use the phrase amplified silence for this, is the way in which this kind of public strategy of remembering the genocide leaves people out and leaves kind of rhetorical strategies or strategies of remembrance out. So can you talk about what you mean by amplified silence and the impact it had?
Sure. So this concept of amplified silence, I use it both as a noun and as a verb. So as a noun, amplified silence is the intense public silence about those experiences of violence that are excluded from public discourse. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in late 1994 and early 1995, there were killings of Hutu by RPF soldiers. And in 1996 and 1997, in Zaire, in the refugee camps, when they were attacked, many civilians were also killed there by the RPF. But these kinds of violences cannot be discussed publicly. And so I call this intense silence around those kinds of violences amplified silence. But it's also a verb in that occlusion or this prevention of discussing things publicly is a silencing, and it's an intense silence. And it's the kind of thing that it took, this is one aspect of understanding post-genocide Rwanda that took me a long time to get my head around. It took me a long time to begin to recognize it in my data, to begin to recognize that there were things that people said, but there were a lot of things people left unsaid, and those unsaid things were almost as important. Sometimes they were more important than the things they said. And then once I figured out that there were all these unsaid things, I had to figure out what were the unsaid things. And then I had to figure out, so why are they unsaid? And does this have a significance? And so I developed this concept of amplified silence, this theoretical concept to explain sort of what's unsaid and how and why is it left unsaid.
So what's distinctive about the experience of women?
Yeah, well, women. I do focus on women in the book. And that was my intent, even in the research process, was to focus on women. I worked closely with women's organizations. Part of why I did this is there have been two different theoretical tendencies in discussing women and war. One is that women are innate peacemakers because of their biology, their destiny to be nurturers and mothers. Women are more likely to oppose war. Women are more likely to not become violent. Women are more likely to also initiate peace building or reconciliation. And the other tendency is to see women only as victims of war. And that women are passive. They just, war sort of washes over them like a wave or something like this, and they're just left there bereft of everything. And so I wanted to get at sort of what is the reality. In the book, I reject both of these two theoretical tendencies. I show in the book, or I try to show, the ways that women exercise their agency, or they do things in response to war and in response to violence. They make choices, no matter how limited those choices might be by the circumstance. They make decisions and they do things to try to get through the day, to try to survive. In the genocide, this is deciding which way to run and where to hide their children and mm-hmm. who to trust their children to. And those are the kinds of decisions. In the aftermath of the genocide, it's to, you know, decide which of my neighbors can I ask to borrow salt from and which should I not approach and those kinds of things. I also reject this notion that women are predestined or biologically programmed to be peacemakers. Now, in Rwanda, it is true, though, that women were the ones who did a lot of the initial work in civil society towards reconciliation, towards peaceful cohabitation, towards peace building. But what I found is that women didn't do this because of some kind of biological predestination. Rather, it's their position in Rwandan society that gave them an opportunity to do these things. In Rwanda, women historically were the primary social interface between the household and the community, in that women were the ones who occupied themselves with cooking for the household and managing the food for the household. So if you were lacking salt to cook the meal, you were the one who organized to borrow it from a neighbor, or you might organize with a neighbor to trade sweet potatoes for beans or these kinds of things. And so this historical position of women, both in terms of the political economy being this interface, but also having lots of social importance in maintaining relationships with other families. In most parts of Rwanda, most Rwandans are subsistence farmers, and you can't get through a day or a week without relying on family, neighbors, or friends to collaborate and cooperate. To trade off work and other kinds of things. And so what I found in my research is that in the aftermath of the genocide, women reached out to each other because it was the only real option they had to get through the day. And one of the groups I focus on was a group of women that was initially organized by a Roman Catholic parish priest in southern Rwanda. And he himself was a genocide survivor. He was sent by the bishop to this community to give mass a few months after the genocide ends. And when he went to the community, what he found was the church was full of women and children who just sat there, who didn't do anything, who didn't speak. They were living off of food assistance they were getting from international NGOs and from the government. And he realized that, you know, I can't give mass to these people because they're not spiritually prepared to receive it. Because they don't, their basic needs aren't being met. They don't have housing. They were staying in the church because they, all of their houses had been destroyed. And he talked to a few of the women and he's like, why are you here? And they said, well, I don't have anywhere to go. I'm a widow. All of my family's been killed. I don't have a house. I don't have clothes. I don't have food. There's no one to take care of me. Now, according to Rwandan tradition, a widow should be taken care of by her surviving sons. Mm-hmm. But if all your sons have been killed, then the what's supposed to happen can't happen. And so initially this parish priest, he gathered together all the widows from the parish and he invited them to a meeting. And he said to them, listen, I understand that you're widows and I understand that you don't have anyone to take care of you. So I will be your son. I will be the son to all of you and I will do what I can to help you rebuild your lives. Now, of course, there were literally hundreds of them. So he couldn't individually help all of them. So instead, he organized them into groups based on where in the community they were from. They would the women's groups would meet. They would often begin their meetings by reading the Bible together. They would the priest organized for them to borrow fields in the valleys from the local governments that they would then cultivate together. He found them, you know, hoes and seeds and the other things necessary to cultivate. So they would do work together. They would pray together and then they would often create small little banks where they would each contribute a tiny bit of money each time they would meet, maybe 10 cents. And then when someone needed to go to the doctor or something, they could borrow from that money or they would share it to help each other out. So what then later happened in this community is so many of these women, the widows that were in these groups, it wasn't only widows of the genocide. It was also widows whose husband had died from natural causes, widows whose husbands had died in killings by the RPF and widows whose husbands had died in prison. After about a year, the priest, he was approached by women whose husbands were in prison. They came to him and they said, listen, we've seen the work you've been doing with these widows. And first of all, we want to thank you because it used to be when we brought food every week to our husbands in the local jail, the children of those women would throw rotten food at us and throw stones at us and insult us. And the widows would say terrible things to us. And they said, you know, now they've stopped doing that, which makes it less hard for us to bring food that we need to bring every week. And they said, but we have the same kinds of problems those women have. We have no men at home. We don't have anyone helping us. And we see what you've done with them. Can you do the same for us? So he then organized the women whose husbands were in prison into small groups. Now, initially they met separate and there was some difficulty. The widows at first were a little bit opposed to this, but eventually he managed to work it all out. And there was a nun who worked with him on this. And then eventually they brought together the leaders of the widows and the leaders of the wives whose husbands were in prison, and they began collaborating together and working together. And I can't say not every member of the Genocide Widows small groups, they weren't all okay with this, but they eventually found a way out. The priest organized to bring, for example, someone who could talk to the women about post-traumatic stress disorder and how to deal with psychological trauma, how to recognize symptoms that are affiliated with it, the kinds of things you can do to cope with it in your daily lives. And then he organized sort of economic assistance and development projects. So the last time I visited these groups of women was in 2011. You know, they had built a greenhouse. They were growing tomatoes to sell in town. They had distributed livestock, goats and cows, to women in the groups. And the plan was then when the goats and the cattle would have babies, they would share them with other women in the groups. There were lots of kinds of activities. But in essence, what these groups did is they did provide this economic assistance, but also they provided this moral and emotional assistance to people and sort of became surrogate families, particularly for those whose families had all been killed.
That's a fascinating story. And for our listeners, I strongly encourage you to get the book and read the book. There are lots of similar narratives that Jenny mines for insights. And the phrase you use, this, and I'm not going to be able to repeat it exactly, but this idea that when things don't work the way they are supposed to work, what do you do now, is a fascinating question. As frankly, and this is a different direction that we won't go now, but is the question of religion and Christianity in Rwanda after the genocide as well. But we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much. I have just a couple questions and conclusions. And the first is, aside from the publisher's demand for a catchy title, why did you choose this title?
Oh, thank you. If I can say it, I didn't choose this title, but it chose my book. Genocide Lives in Us. This is the response a genocide survivor gave to me to explain what it's like to survive genocide. I had shared with her the story of another genocide survivor friend and the struggle she was facing. And she said, yes, that is how it is for us. The genocide lives in us. And initially I understood. Even at the time she said it, I found it to be quite poetic and quite it captured sort of an essence of what life in the aftermath of genocide is like for people. But I also found that it captures the sense of what having survived genocide is like also for Hutu in Rwanda, whether they were targeted in the genocide or whether they participated in the genocide, you know, they also carry the genocide with them. So the title, in my opinion, it sort of captures the ways that Rwandans of all ethnicities are haunted by the genocide. They can't forget it because it sort of lives inside their bodies. And it sort of captures the sense that a lot of the sort of psychosomatic symptoms of trauma that people have is sort of one manifestation of this. It's their memories. And it's also the moral responsibility that those who participated in the killing have, and that they can't escape it. And we can even broaden it out that sort of the possibility or the potential for genocide lives in all human beings. It's not that Rwandans are any different than the rest of us. They just, in 1994, lived at a particular historical moment where genocide became possible.
So the last question, what are you working on now?
Oh, thanks. I'm doing another research project in Rwanda, also about genocide. This project is trying to understand sort of the intrinsic and extrinsic motivations, or the internal and external motivations of rescuers during the genocide. So we're trying to understand, there have been other social scientists, Scott Strauss, Leanne Fuji, who've studied in depth sort of the motivations of perpetrators and why Rwandans became involved in killing in the genocide. I'm trying to understand sort of the opposite of that, sort of those, why did people put themselves at risk of death to save and help Tutsi in the genocide? Because that was the reality. If you were caught hiding Tutsi or helping Tutsi, you would be killed. This did occur. There were people who did it. One other aspect we're trying to investigate is the differences between Christians and Muslims on this factor. At In 1994, Muslims are a very small portion of the population, between 3 and 5% at the most. Probably 3% is more accurate. And what's interesting is we found some communities where the Muslim community as a community organized to save Tutsi and protect Tutsi. And you can't, I haven't yet found the same for communities of Christians. I have found Christians who did that. I have found priests and pastors who tried to save people, but not at the same level of organization. And so that's what we're working on now. We're in the midst of field work for that. And I'm hoping in another 2 years, if we're lucky, we'll start publishing the results of that study.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I'm impressed that your goal is 2 years rather than 15. But when you're done, you'll be willing to come back on the show and talk about your new book. And I really enjoyed the book that you just finished and the interview we had. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Kelly. It's my pleasure.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
You've been listening to an interview with Jenny Burnett, author of the new book, Genocide Lives in Us, Women, Memory, and Silence in Rwanda. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll interview Philip Dwyer and Lindahl Ryan about their edited volume, Theaters of Violence, Massacre, Mass Killing, and Atrocity Throughout History, as well as the special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research that the two co-edited. Until then, I hope you have a great month.